Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about the condition of China in 1945 at the end of the Second World War. Now, the go-to book on the period 1945 to 1957 is The Tragedy of Liberation by Frank Dakota. Frank Dakota has, in his trilogy of books about China, from 1945 to the death of Mao in 1976, come in for a little criticism from some reviewers who saying that he's presented events as being unremittingly bleak and suggesting that there was no upside whatsoever. It's difficult really to look at Maoism in any particularly positive light. There were social groups that benefited under Maoism, but many of the people who did benefited temporarily. For example, if you think of China's peasants who did enjoy land redistribution, but then were forced into communes and afflicted by Mao's famine. So it is difficult to see any upside to Maoism, but if you look at the studies done by Sheila Fitzpatrick and in her book Everyday Stalinism, the horrors of Stalinism didn't impede into the lives of all individuals every day, but all individuals were shaped by a hyper-bureaucratic system which was riddled with corruption and bent by utopian ideologies, forcing them to have to kind of adapt. So perhaps we need an everyday Maoism. Just saying, Mr. Dakota, if you're listening. So the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August the 6th, 1945, followed by the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki brought the Second World War to an end, and the unconditional surrender of Japan, which was obviously cheered across China as the Japanese invasion of China from 1937 onwards had been one of the most horrific and bloody periods in Chinese history. The city of Chongqing, which had been Chiang Kai-shek's capital, was exploded into jubilation, as did cities across China. And in 1945, the future for Chiang Kai-shek seemed relatively stable. He had American backing. There had been considerable American presence in China during the war and large amounts of lend-lease aid. And the final unfinished business was to deal with the communists, which Chiang saw he was eminently possible. Just to let you know what the Chinese people had suffered during the Second World War, there is a brilliant book, China's War with Japan by Rana Mitter, which says quite rightly that the Chinese are really left out of the many of the kind of the official canons of knowledge about the Second World War. Their Second World War began earlier. It began in 1937 and it lasted till 1945 with an estimated 14 million people killed. So the Chinese War was on its own a vast and murderous enterprise. For example, the most infamous atrocity was the slaughter at Nanjing in December 1937, where civilians and soldiers, Chinese disarmed soldiers and prisoners, were systematically slaughtered and executed. The killing went on for 6 weeks. There were men and women rounded up and machine gunned. They were men who were blown up, stabbed with bayonets and Japanese katana swords. Horrendous sexual violence towards women. It's entirely possible that up to 300,000 people were killed. And at this point, Japanese nationalism, which had initially had certain liberal aspects to it, Japanese nationalism in the early 20th century had been had embraced a kind of opposition to European imperialism and a belief that Japan was the power that would liberate Asia and become the linchpin around which a new Asia would organise itself, free and independent and democratic. Of course, this doesn't materialise because the Japanese occupation of China and Southeast Asia and the Pacific is far more brutal and violent than anything the Europeans could contrive to dream up. And that really, when you look at some, say for example, the behaviour of the French in Vietnam, that really is going something. And the reality of Japanese occupation in Asia was that for every one Allied prisoner of war who died, 100 Asians, be they Malays, Filipinos, Chinese, Indian, Burmese, or whoever, 100 times more Asians died than Europeans. And it's always quite salutary to remember that when you're watching films like Bridge on the River Kwai. Japan had used and experimented with biological and chemical weapons, a Japanese sense of racial superiority, this kind of perversion of what was a previously liberal nationalist outlook into racial supremacy was not entirely dissimilar to the way in which the Nazis looked upon themselves as superior to Slavic people. The Chinese at certain points were seen as a potential pupil to Japan, that Japan could mentor to become a modern, empowered and liberated nation. But that really gives way to a racial chauvinism and then a simply an almost genocidal view that it would be far better if the Chinese were wiped out and their lands were replaced or occupied by Japanese people. The Japanese had a similar Lebensraum kind of mentality when they looked at China and thought themselves as a martial people, a growing people, confined on their island chain and needing the vast spaces of China to grow in. Experiments were carried out on POWs, and there were secret laboratories from Manchuria to Guangdong, all the way down from the north to the south in China. Victims were subjected to vivisection without anaesthesia after being infected with various germs. There was their amputations and other horrific, horrific experiments, including flamethrowers and chemical weapons being tested on prisoners. So the most notorious centre for this kind of monstrosity was Unit 731 in Harbin, which was built along with an aerodrome, a railway station, barracks, laboratories, operating rooms, crematoria, a cinema, and even a Shinto temple. And it contained fleas, contaminated fleas and infected clothing were developed to spread plague, anthrax and cholera when dropped on civilians in encased bombs. So Japan was developing really the tools of genocide. They were trying to answer the same monstrous questions that the Nazis in Europe were attempting to answer as to how can one use the tools of modernity with science and engineering to wipe out an entire people. And their unit 731 was a sophisticated and advanced centre of research and genocide industry. The invasion of Japan obviously caused enormous population transfers. The Japanese forced tens of millions of refugees to move southwards to particularly Yunnan and Sichuan, and these were the centres of Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government. But it didn't mean that civilians could be anywhere, could be out of the firing line anywhere, because of the development of air power. In Europe, politicians such as Neville Chamberlain, Stanley Baldwin and Winston Churchill looked on with dread at the operation of Japanese air power, noting that now there was no safety against attack from the air, particularly as the Japanese were quite happy to bombard and terrorise civilians, realising that air power was now a potent terror weapon. Now here's an extract from Rana Mitter's book on China's war with Japan, and he describes the bombing of Chongqing. He says, "In the spring of 1939, Europe was still, albeit uneasily, at peace. But some 7,000 kilometres to the east, the Second World War was already well underway. On the 3rd of May, the sky was clear above the southwestern Chinese city of Chongqing. The weather was sweltering. Not for nothing is Chongqing known as one of China's three great furnaces, where temperatures regularly rise to 40 degrees or higher. At noon, Zhang Zhilu, a reporter for the Jinminbao newspaper, was getting ready for lunch. In the bustling city around him, the locals were going about their usual business. On the docks, stevedores hauled boxes on and off the ships that plied the Yangtze. Passengers descending from the boats would be mobbed by dozens of sedan chair bearers. Chongqing is famous as a shancheng, a mountain city, far better to be carried up the steep hills that separate the river from the upper town, if you could afford it. In the markets, traders and their clients bargained for rice, vegetables and meat. The number of customers was greater than at any time in the city's history. In October 1937, the nationalist government in China had announced that it could no longer defend the existing capital at Nanjing and to the east against a Japanese invasion that had begun 3 months earlier. Chongqing, therefore, became the temporary capital. Millions of refugees had fled westwards, and Chongqing's population swelled. A city of fewer than 500,000 inhabitants in 1937 more than doubled in size.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yes. Aside from the crowded markets, the refugees' presence was clear from the ugly slapdash buildings made from mud and metal girders that had rapidly sprung up across the local landscape. These shanties gave an already slovenly-looking city an even more unkempt air. Suddenly, as he was sitting down, Zhang heard a sound whose terrifying significance he knew well. At about noon, we heard a short alarm signal, he recalled. I didn't even finish my meal, but I got ready to go and hide in the air raid shelter in the newspaper office in Jintang Street. Half an hour passed, then an even more urgent siren began howling in the short, continuous bursts. The last few people left in the newspaper office grabbed their possessions and ran down into the shelter. At 12:45 p.m, dots appeared in the sky, 36 of them. They swiftly grew larger and louder. From airfields in occupied China, the Japanese Navy could dispatch Type 96 land attacking aircraft, able to fly over 1,000 kilometres on a single fueling. The Japanese were almost invulnerable and could bomb the Chinese government in exile into submission. From inside the shelter, Zhang heard the noise of aircraft engines. Firstly, he made out the pitifully small number of Chinese Air Force fighters sent up to engage the enemy. Not long afterwards, he heard the sound of bombs dropping and the booming response of the Chinese anti-aircraft guns. The raid continued for a full hour before the all-clear was finally sounded. Zhang went to see the damage. All across the city, from the docks to the residential districts, the buildings were gutted, bombed into hollow wrecks. So complete was the destruction that the surviving buildings seemed to him the strangest of all. At one junction, a cluster of banks stood undamaged amidst the rubble of endless flattened structures. Okay, so that gives you just a flavour of the kind of terror that was meted out on the Chinese people from Japan. Not just once, but endlessly over an 8-year period. And then there would be another 4 years of civil war to contend with, which would end with the development of communism in China and the ascension of Mao Zedong as the first leader of communist China. The brutality of that civil war is hard to explain and hard to describe if you ignore the Japanese invasion of China and the monstrous cruelties inflicted by Japan on the Chinese people. So once the Japanese were defeated, the vast numbers of refugees that had fled to the interior, away from the occupied north and the coastal regions that Japan occupied, began to go home. And millions and millions of exiles began packing up their belongings, selling what they had accumulated, and preparing to return to their homes. The Japanese surrendered to the Chinese on the 21st of August at Zhejiang Airfield in Henan Province, and Major General Takeo Imai of the Imperial Japanese Army was forced to hand over maps showing the positions of a million Japanese troops in China. These troops were actually allowed to retain their arms, and this was a pattern that was found in Indochina as well. The British allowed the Japanese to retain their arms because it was virtually impossible for the British to maintain order and have an orderly handover of Indochina back to the Vietnamese. Otherwise, the Japanese were used as auxiliary troops in China, in Indochina, until obviously the nationalist troops turned up. the greatest fear that the nationalists had was that parts of the country would be abandoned by the occupying Japanese and handed directly over to the communists. And the nationalists had help in taking those positions that were going to be very quickly vacated by the Japanese. The cities south of the Great Wall were the scene of a huge, huge American Air Force airlift. For example, 80,000 troops alone were flown by the US Air Force to Nanjing. Shanghai saw the Nationalist 94th Army airdropped and airlifted to quickly seize the city. And the Americans knew that time was of the essence. And on average, every single day, up to 4,000 Nationalist soldiers were in the air on the orders of General Albert Wedemeyer, who was one of Roosevelt's many top soldiers in China. A significant complicating factor in the days after the detonation of the atomic bomb was the decision by Stalin to declare war on Japan. Stalin had promised Churchill and Roosevelt at the Yalta Conference that he would intervene against Japan once Nazi Germany was defeated. Of course, 3 months later, Roosevelt had died and was replaced with Harry Truman. And Truman had wished, really, that Roosevelt had never asked Stalin for this kind of undertaking. Stalin had a price for his involvement. He wanted the old Russian treaty ports of Dalian and Port Arthur back. Stalin also wanted to have to extend his control over Manchuria by controlling the Manchurian railway system, which was a joint Chinese and Russian enterprise anyway, dating back to Tsarist times. Roosevelt was absolutely fine with these concessions and behaved much as Churchill tended to do, signing away Chiang Kai-shek's rights without even consulting him. Stalin asked for 2 months' food supply and fuel for an army of 1.5 million soldiers. That would mean that China would pay for a Soviet occupation of itself. Roosevelt thought that this was, again, eminently reasonable and sent vast sums of lend-lease equipment, including 500 Sherman tanks, to the Soviets. This meant that the Soviets were able to keep a million men in Siberia, and on the 8th of August they crossed the Amur River into Manchuria and poured southwards on armoured trains and used the East China Railway system to reach Harbin, travelling at over 70 kilometres a day, which was a kind of a rapid pace for war in chaotic China. It was to be the occupation of Manchuria that would give Mao a huge head start in the Chinese Civil War, the resumed Chinese Civil War that was about to begin again and last for the next 4 years. By occupying Manchuria, the Stalin could give Mao and the Chinese communists a safe place to operate from and to retreat to. Stalin didn't want open confrontation between Mao and the Nationalists just yet. Firstly, he wanted America out of China. He thought that America in China and Korea, armed with an atomic bomb, was extremely dangerous for him, and particularly as Mao was intent on fomenting outright war with them, drawing potentially Stalin and Truman against one another in a proxy war. Stalin tells Mao in 1945 to slow down, to avoid direct confrontation. One of his plans was to send a guerrilla force of undercover fighters into Shanghai and to rise up and seize the city. His intelligence told him that the nationalists hopelessly outnumbered him and that there was a low level of popular support for the communists in the financial centre of China, Shanghai. And Mao, under pressure from Stalin, a pressure that he always resented and never quite forgave, backed down. Mao looked to Stalin's occupation of Manchuria and was deeply resentful, essentially petulantly thinking, why are Soviet communist forces able to act in this particular way, where the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese communists, are forced into second place and told when to sit down by Stalin himself. Stalin's occupation of Manchuria obviously offers a solve to these hurts, and Mao was able to take comfort in the 100,000 troops he was able to secure in this nice communist-occupied territory from Outer Mongolia into Manchuria. In 1945, on the 20th of August, Stalin sends a message to Mao saying that he must not confront the nationalists. Prior to that, Stalin had signed the Sino-Soviet Treaty with Chiang Kai-shek, recognising him as the leader of a united China. On one level, Stalin hoped that this would appease the Americans for long enough for them to think that China was secure and for them to eventually go home. But Stalin also thought, well, if a revolution doesn't come off in China, I'm relatively happy dealing with Chiang Kai-shek. He may not be a communist, but I kind of get the guy he is. And the idea of having a fairly stable China on my doorstep, albeit led by a nationalist strongman, well, Stalin had dealt with far worse than that, that's not too much of a problem. Mao was always an unknown and untested quantity to Stalin, and Stalin finally makes up his mind about Mao significantly later, as we shall see. This decision by Stalin to back Chiang Kai-shek came with an implicit threat that Stalin should have all the concessions in China that he wanted. His chief negotiator, T.V. Sung, went to Moscow and agreed to hand over the treaty ports and the railway network of Manchuria. And in order to prevent, really, Stalin from changing his mind and backing a communist-occupied north and resulting in, really, the partition of China. Now, we're going to continue that later in the week and look at the events that unfold when Chiang Kai-shek in 1945 meets Mao for the first time in just over two decades. I hope you found that useful today. If you like these podcasts and you're keen to support them, check out a link in this podcast, the blurb below, to our Patreon page. It would be a treat if you can support us. If not, please go over to our iTunes page, give us a good review, give us 5 stars, because it all helps to get the word out. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.